Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org.
It's a sacred obligation for the VA to take care of these patients, and they need to do that. And so part of it is checking if they're going to refer people to the private sector. You have to know what the quality of care those people, veterans, are receiving.
That was Bruce Carruthers with some hopeful news.
I'm just very heartened by the courage and the moral leadership from these brave young people. They're recalling the best traditions of this country, you know.
That was Aaron Mate on the growing student protests across the country. And we will also update you on the Freedom Flotilla and the, as you probably know, between the United States and Israel. They were blocked from setting sail, but they're not done yet. But first, my name is Jim Wohlgemuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country, thanks to the Pacifica Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcasts, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps Radio Free Nashville going. And as a result, this radio show is then picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network so that we are heard across the country. So if you think this is important, just go to radiofreenashville.org, click on the donate button, and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone in the U.S. And if you support Veterans for Peace, go to veteransforpeace.org. We've got a donate button there also. Today, we're welcoming back Bruce Carruthers, our veterans healthcare expert that we have on our radio show on a regular basis. Save our VA expert.
Right.
And so, Bruce, you reached out and said you had important information. And so what's going on? What should veterans, families of veterans, friends of veterans know about?
Well, I think we've talked before about the impact of privatization or sending veterans to the private sector instead of treating them in the VA. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs got to be so concerned about that, apparently, that he called a group of people together, what they refer to as a red team. And apparently that comes from the intelligence community. A red team is when there's kind of an emergency situation and they call together a group to look at it. Maybe not emergency, but an urgent situation. And so the team was led by Ken Kaiser, who's a former undersecretary for health in the VA, and really was responsible in large measure for modernizing the VA. The team got together in March, and they've issued a report, which for some reason the VA hasn't released to the public yet, although several copies have been leaked, and everybody in Congress has a copy of the report. The Red Team report is pretty critical of VA outsourcing on a number of dimensions and says clearly that it's not sustainable, that the VA can't continue to spend so much of its budget on care in the private sector and what's called the community or the Veterans Community Care Program and maintain its four missions. And, you know, and not everybody's aware of the fact that besides providing health care for veterans, the VA has a powerhouse research program. It's also one of the prime educators of health care professionals in the U.S. 70% of doctors receive at least some of the training in VA facilities. And then it is what's called national preparedness. It's a backup for civilian and military hospitals in the case of an emergency. And during the COVID pandemic, it offered a lot of assistance, up to sending some of its nurses to private hospitals to assist. So anyway, the report is quite critical of what's going on. It makes recommendations for what the VA needs to do to reverse this privatization.
So that sounds pretty positive if the report is coming out and saying, wait a second, you can't continue to outsource or VA won't be able to fulfill its mission. So that's pretty positive, isn't it?
Well, it'll be positive if the VA acts on it. I mean, that's what we have to see. If the secretary apparently asked for this study, and we'll see if he acts on it, if he does anything about it. Some of the points they made, for example, is that the cost of this Veterans Community Program has increased dramatically. It went from $14.8 billion in fiscal year 2018 to $28.5 billion in fiscal year 23, and it'll be over $30 billion this year. And that comes out of the VA's funds for healthcare. initially, when the Choice Act was passed, there was a separate budget line for that, and if the VA needed more money for it, it had to go back to Congress. But under the Mission Act, that's not the case. If the VA has to outsource people, it comes from their budget, which of course means then they can't provide care in the VA. And at the rate it's increasing, what Kaiser and other people have been saying for some time now, and the secretary himself said before Congress, this is not sustainable. The VA can't maintain the kind of organization it is and continue to spend this much money outsourcing that. This Veterans Community Program is managed by two entities, Optum, which is a part of United Healthcare, and then Tri-West Healthcare Alliance, and there are five regions. So in Region 1, which is essentially the Atlantic Coast Northeast, up from about, includes, I think, Pennsylvania all the way up through Maine, maybe a little further south, they recently got a $4 billion increase for their contract for the rest of the year, saying they don't have enough money because of the number of referrals. And it's estimated that altogether these regions will ask for about another $83 billion to manage that. And they're not providers of health care. What they do is they arrange the treatments. They hire providers and they arrange the treatments. So, and then they charge for it. And it's just not sustainable. And I don't know what percentage they take, what the percentage of profit is. But I think it's generally known that health insurance companies take around 15%, 15 to 20% for what they call administrative costs. But that's primarily profit. In a way to compare, administrative costs for Medicare are 4%. That's what it costs for them to administer the Medicare health care program. So, you know, a lot of that is just profit. The point that the report makes is the VA just can't continue to spend that kind of money on the private sector and maintain itself as a premier healthcare provider.
So is this Optum and TriWest, is this something that people have to opt out of when they call for an appointment? If they're told we can provide you with an appointment in the community. I mean, it seems like those companies have a vested interest in directing as many people as possible.
Well, it's supposed to be, the VA is supposed to be the healthcare provider of choice. So, but what actually happens in practice is, and I can tell you this from, I get my healthcare at the VA Asheville. When you call the VA number, the first thing they talk about is the Mission Act and how to get care in the private sector. And they will often offer you an appointment in the private sector. And I tell them I prefer to get my care at the VA. But the VA is supposed to be the first choice, but in fact, often is. You're supposed to be offered an appointment in the private sector if the VA can't meet timeliness standards or distance standards. So if you're too far away from a VA facility, then you can be offered care in the private sector. If the VA can't meet certain timeliness standards, then. But the thing is, there is no measurement of how well these community health care providers do in meeting either. Right. I mean, you know, once a patient is referred to the private sector, there's nobody tracking that. And there's evidence that it's more expensive to send patients to the private sector. You know, they work on a for-profit basis, so there's an incentive to order tests that may or may not be necessary. There's an incentive to do procedures that may not be necessary. There was a study of prostate patients from the VA referred to the private sector. And what it found was the general sort of state of the art, the procedure is if a man has prostate cancer and it's not over a certain level, then what is called for is active surveillance. That patient gets, ESA. What is it called? Yes, that. And then that's followed. If that goes up, then they will do an MRI, for example. But they found in the private sector that they're often being referred for surgery or more expensive procedures. Same thing for orthopedics. And so those are independent studies, but the VA doesn't monitor what happens in the private sector. I signed up for VA IG reports, and at least once a week, one of the VA facilities is reviewed thoroughly, recommendations are made, and the facility has to respond to it. There are no comparable surveys of what's going on in the private sector. So the VA doesn't really know what the quality of care is in the private sector, but there are numerous studies that show, in fact, the VA care is at least equal to and often superior and more timely than that offered in the private sector. Mm-hmm. There was a recent study, for example, of how female veterans did with surgical procedures in the VA compared to the private sector. They did a comprehensive study, And one of the reasons they did it is the majority of VA patients are men, but increasingly women are a bigger part of the VA workload because, you know, women are such an important part of the military now, unlike it was in the past. Anyway, they concluded that post-operative mortality was significantly lower in VA compared with private sector hospitals. In combination with prior work, these findings challenge the assumption that shifting care to the private sector can improve timeliness of surgical care without diminishing its quality. They go on to say veterans are unique patients that benefit from the tailored care processes and resources VA has developed, which are not and cannot be offered to the same extent or availability in the private sector. And that's one of the key issues that we've been pushing. I'm also on the steering committee of the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute. And one of the points we've been trying to push is that veterans are a unique patient population based both on their experience in the military and on the age of a lot of veterans. Veterans tend to have a lot more medical health issues and psychological issues than the general population does. VA providers are trained in those issues. Healthcare providers in the private sector aren't. They can take training, but very few of them do. They're not required to take training. And that issue has been pushed. And what the VA says, and in fact, what Senator Tester from Montana, who's the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee, said, well, if we force them to take training, these doctors won't take patients from the VA. Well, our response is, well, fine. If they won't take training in veterans issues, they shouldn't be treating veterans. I mean, you know, for example, so if you're a Vietnam veteran and you have a cardiac condition, a VA doctor will say to you, well, you may be eligible for service compensation because you're exposed to Agent Orange. A private sector doctor doesn't know that, doesn't know about military sexual trauma, doesn't know about PTSD, may not know about traumatic brain injury, about toxic exposure for post 9/11 veterans. All VA providers are trained in these areas. And there's just really no review at all of the quality, of the timeliness of what goes on in the private sector. There's some sort of basic assumption that care is better in the private sector than in the VA, when in fact, numerous studies show that the opposite is true.
Does the study talk about the impact of privatizing the VA with regard to doctors of the future? I just went to the VA, which sits right next to Vanderbilt. I just went to them for an eye appointment. And the doctor I had for my eyes was actually a resident from Vanderbilt. Does the report mention anything about that impact there?
Well, they do. They talk about the fact that, and that's an important thing. As I mentioned, 70% of doctors receive some training in the VA. Throughout the country, where possible, VA medical centers have a strong affiliation with medical schools. So you mentioned Vanderbilt, for example. I worked at the Lexington VA, and at the hospital was on the grounds, the same grounds as the University of Kentucky Medical School. The same thing at Denver. I worked at the Birmingham Hospital, the same thing. In Durham, the VA hospital is built right next to Duke. So what happens is the physicians and residents have joint appointments. They often work both at the VA and at that facility. So it benefits veterans because they have access to all that happens at the medical school, you know, which you're usually very advanced. And so if we keep sending patients out to the private sector, what will happen is it'll jeopardize that educational program, and VA patients may not have access to the same kind of care from these medical schools that they have now.
I think you mentioned that the private sector facilities that veterans are being sent to or being recommended to. And for example, I had to get some sort of procedure done, and they immediately recommended a facility that was 10 minutes away from me versus me going into the VA, which is 25 minutes away from me. So I said, no, I'd rather go to the VA hospital rather than the private sector. Okay. So if I get the procedure from the private sector, I know they're going to send results to the VA. Well, are they?
That's one of the issues. And one of the recommendations was what happens is the biggest cost for this community care program is the emergency room.
Okay.
A veteran goes to the emergency room and then that facility keeps the patient. And what Dr. Kaiser and the people recommending, if they go to an emergency room, the patient should be returned to the VA and treated at the VA, and that would reduce costs significantly. Mm-hmm. They will share those results with the VA, but it's pretty sketchy. The VA has often has a hard time getting results from these private care facilities, and they're not as integrated into the VA electronic record as they would be if the patient was seen in the VA. If it was 10 minutes and 25 minutes, you shouldn't have been offered care at a private sector, because the VA is well within the distance and the time limits. The VA is a provider of choice, so you shouldn't have been offered an alternative. And for some reason, that's what's going on in the VA. You only should have been offered that if the VA couldn't schedule the appointment within a certain time or you lived a certain distance from there. And if they could appoint that, they should. If they can't, what the VA should be doing is hiring staff to make those appointments. So, for example, at the VA in Asheville, it's difficult to get an eye exam. You have to schedule way in advance. And so the point I tried to make there is, well, then you ought to hire another optometrist.
Right.
Because, given the age of VA patients, you're going to have an awful lot of people who need eye exams. And if you can't provide it there, you shouldn't be sending them to the private sector. You should hire another optometrist and provide those services at the VA, which is essentially what the red team is encouraging the VA to do, to staff up, to provide these services in-house and let the VA be the provider of choice and only refer patients outside when the VA can't provide that. There are times when that's reasonable. So you live 2 hours from a VA facility and you need an appointment for an eye exam. There's no reason to have you drive 2 hours to get an eye exam. And the VA's always done that. They've always had sort of contract people, but the VA managed that. There was not a third party managing that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to mention two other things that are important to mention. The VA does surveys of veterans on how satisfied they are with VA care because, conservative groups are saying veterans don't like the VA. They don't like to go to the VA. Well, in the last survey the VA did, they did a survey in fiscal year 2021, and they found that 89.3% of inpatient veterans reported they trusted the VA for their health care. That was 88% in the year before that. In 2023, 90.4% of veterans who surveyed reported that they trusted the VA and that they were happy with their care at the VA. Medicare does surveys about how people are satisfied with the care that they get. And in that survey, they found that in almost every dimension, the VA outranked private hospitals. So as part of the survey, Medicare awards star ratings from 1 to 5, with more stars representing better quality. Based on patient surveys, 72% of VA hospitals received 4 or 5 stars overall rating, compared to 48% of private sector hospitals. So all the propaganda about the VA not being a good place to get health care and veterans not liking it are just not true. It provides excellent care, and there are going to be mistakes. It's a huge organization. Any healthcare facility is going to make some mistakes. And that's true of private sector hospitals, too. They just don't get the same kind of publicity the VA does.
So the red team, they seem to be pretty good. Who's on the red team?
Who is on the red team?
Because it sounds like they're good citizens.
There is an ex-secretary of health for the VA. There is a DOD person who worked in DOD health. And then there are a couple people from the private sector who are in healthcare. When the VA releases this report publicly, then I'll be sure you get a copy of it.
Okay. What's the holdup? Why isn't VA?
I don't know.
Is it not going along with the message?
Well, I don't know why. I suppose they're unhappy with the results. I don't know. They commissioned the study, so why they won't release it, I'm not sure. But anyway, it's been disseminated. And people in Congress have that. So we've written one of our letters, a call to action about the red team. So we're hoping that action will be taken on it by our allies in Congress. But there's been no official response to why it hasn't been released.
Okay, so, and you got a copy of the study. How'd you get one?
I got a bootleg copy, and I don't want to say where I got it from.
Okay, so we're still This is like a covert operation here.
Yeah, a little bit. It's kind of a bootleg copy, but I got it from a reliable source, but I don't want to say at this point where I got it from.
Yeah. What else is in the study that you'd like to share with us so that I mean, this is encouraging, and I kind of like this as long as it can get out to the public, because
Yeah, I think so.
maybe we could get some funding.
I think, and Susan Gordon and Steve Early wrote an article on it in American Prospect article, and that gives kind of a good review of the report.
That kind of gives a review of the report, and that's from Susan Gordon and Steve Early.
And that'll give you a good idea, kind of a summary of what's in the report.
Excellent.
One of the points that they made, you're talking about important points, is they said if the VA has to keep funding the community care program at the increase that's going on, it'll be likely forced to consider eliminating VA direct care for some services or closing facilities. That's how dire the situation will be. It'll have to drop some services.
We've been talking about for years that VA needs to staff up, but if it continues, then we'd be really facing staff cuts.
Yeah, staff cuts are what would happen because the VA can't afford to hire its own people and keep paying for referring patients to the private care. You know, there are a certain number of people in Congress who don't care. I mean, they just think that patients should be sent to the private care. I'm not private sector. I'm not sure why, but there do seem to be more people in Congress who are getting alarmed. Even Jerry Moran from Kansas. He's been a proponent of outsourcing. He and Tester wrote to the senator asking about this. So I think the cost of it is starting to alarm people. You know what they say, follow the money. So it could be the cost of this might really start to get to alarm Congress because if the whole VA is outsourced and given the profit that the private sector makes, the cost would either go up dramatically or services would be cut to veterans, one or the other. Other issue, I think I did mention that community care providers are not required to take VA training. And the there's was a report, I think, from could have been Congressional Budget Office or OMB, anyway, that the VA is not vetting some of these providers the way they should. And the question we raised was, what do you mean the VA is not vetting them? If these community care providers are being paid billions of dollars and are hiring the doctors, they should vet them. They
Sure.
shouldn't be hiring any doctors who are not qualified to work. It ought to be the responsibility of these people. But you know what'll happen? If you tell them they have to do that, they'll say, oh God, we have to have more money for that.
Yeah.
This study, should people call their congressperson and say, get the red team to release the study?
Well, they should, yeah. They should call them and they should ask them if they looked at the red team report and tell them that the VA should release or support the commission so the public can comment on
Yeah, and that should generate hearings.
it. I think it should. It should generate hearings. I think that the Veterans Affairs Committee and maybe the Appropriation Committee ought to take a look at this and hold hearings on it and get testimony from the people who are on the red team to see where their conclusions came from. And the red team made recommendations for follow-up studies, and the VA should commission those follow-up studies. I mean, one of my main complaints has been I see every week comprehensive reports on what's going on in VA facilities, and I've written and asked, why aren't you doing comprehensive reports on these community care providers? If you're so worried about the quality of care, which you should be, you should also be worried about the quality of care when so many patients, some 40% of patients now get some of their care in the private sector. So you should be looking at these people just as closely as you look at the VA. Less than 1% of Americans now serve in the military. So the burden on these few people that serve, unlike when we were, when there was a draft and so a greater number of people served, the burden on these people is incredible. In Afghanistan, Iraq, people had four, five, six tours of duty. And so it's a sacred obligation for the VA to take care of these patients, and they need to do that. And so part of it is checking if they're going to refer people to the private sector, you have to know what the quality of care those people, veterans, are receiving.
Let me ask you this, and this might be off the wall, but I know the VA has the right to negotiate its drug prices.
Yes.
Well, if things are pushed more out into the private sector, do those drug prices go along,
Well,
or?
one of the recommendations is to require these private care sectors to use the VA pharmacy because, the VA gets incredible savings on pharmaceuticals because it negotiates on a nationwide basis, something that Medicare is just starting to do. And so
Yeah.
they don't, in cost for pharmaceuticals in the private sector are anywhere from 10 to 100% higher than they are in the VA. So
Yeah.
one of the RITINGS recommendation was make these doctors use the VA pharmacy. If they want a medication, order from the VA, and the VA will provide it at a much less cost and great saving to the VA. My medication from in the mail from the VA, it's incredibly convenient.
Is.
I just
So
go
you're saying the
online and
VA, that comes out of the VA budget, the cost of the prescription drugs and people in
well,
the
it
community.
does. It certainly does. And so
Wow.
But yeah, you probably do that. So you just go online, you order your drugs, and in a couple of days they show up in the mail. It
Yeah.
couldn't be any easier.
Yeah, it's worked real well for me.
Me
Yeah, for
too.
me too.
What else is important for people to know, Bruce, and
Well,
since
I think
yeah.
what's important to know is what this defines is this Red Team report, or what many veterans who have been saying all along, that this is not sustainable. That
Yeah.
the VA is a world-class healthcare organization, and it has become that way over the last several decades, and it needs to be preserved. That this outsourcing is destroying the VA. And so let me make a point. So if you have conditions from result from Agent Orange, like I have a cardiac condition that's presumed related to Agent Orange, you're not going to know that thing till your middle or late age. If the VA isn't sustained, when all these post-9/11 veterans really start having problems from toxic exposure, traumatic brain injuries, if the VA is not around, there isn't going to be anybody to really provide treatment for them, do research on this, or track what's going on. So it's really important for today's veterans, and for today's military people who will become veterans and future veterans, that the VA is around to provide the kind of care that they need.
Do you think, since the number of veterans is diminishing, do you think it's kind of off the radar with regard to our Congress and et cetera, the people who make the policy?
It shouldn't be. The PACT Act, the act that extended presumed service connection for toxic exposure and other things, has increased the potential enrollment in the VA healthcare substantially. So while the number of veterans is declining, the number of veterans who use the VA has actually been increasing. It,
Okay.
unless we unless we change our sort of foreign policy, unless we decide we're not going to be policemen of the world and start to have a much smaller military, I don't see the reason for the VA going away anytime in the future. We would have to be, have to have a much different foreign policy than we have now. I mean, we have some 600 or 700 bases all around the world, and we have military people stationed all around the world, and often in very difficult situations. So unless we had a small military and only a few bases overseas, I don't see there being any reason for the VA not to continue to be maintain the vigorous organization.
Yeah, and it's not just because we're close, those bases are close to combat areas. We just had Pat Elder on about 6 weeks ago, talking about the PFAs that are running rampant on military bases. And
Right.
so that's another issue of a toxic substance. So.
And then, of course, all the these the results of these burn pits that people in the Middle East had, many of those kind of things are not known for years afterwards. I mean, what
Right.
I read is that that would never have been allowed in the United States, the toxic exposure. And there were actually regulations against that, but the military ignored that. I mean, apparently they burned everything in those pits. It's hard to imagine what it was like. My first assignment when I got to Vietnam was burning waste, human waste. It was in those 50-gallon drums, and you were supposed to pour kerosene on and stir it.
Yeah.
We poured kerosene on, but we didn't do any stirring. I mean,
Mm-hmm.
that was bad enough. I can't imagine what these burn pits were like.
Well, what else do you have to tell the audience other than call your congressman? Oh, and what was the article that they might be able to look up from Susan Gordon and Steve Early?
It's in the American Prospect.
So just search Susan Gordon and Steve Early in the American Prospect to learn more about it. Bruce, it's always good to see you.
And good to see you guys. Let me know when you're going to be in Asheville again.
Thanks for coming on and giving us the update on the VA.
I'm happy to do it. And if something else comes up, I'll do the same thing.
All right.
Great. Thank
You
you.
guys take it
Thanks,
easy.
Bruce.
You too. Take care, Bruce.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. So there was Bruce Carruthers. And remember, call your congressman and tell them to release the red team report from the VA concerning VA services. So now on with the rest of the show. We need to update the folks on a couple of things. I got an update from Vanderbilt. Three of us from Veterans for Peace, Craig Bardo, Tom Gross, and myself. We met close to the Vanderbilt campus with three signs and a VFP flag. The sign said reinstate the Vandy Three, referring to the three students that have been expelled. Another sign referenced the student movement from 50 years ago. Noting that those students were right to protest Vietnam. We found out later on they were on the right side of history. And so these students, the poster went on, these students are right again today to protest our support of a genocidal Israel. And then our third sign was BDS Now. And with regard to the students expelled and the more than 20 students suspended, their appeal appears to have been accepted. But the problem is it's going to take weeks to adjudicate. And what happens to adjudicate in that meantime? Well, we got finals, we got
So these,
graduations, we got the end of the semester, and these students are in limbo.
they can't go to class, they can't get in their dorm rooms,
So
and the ones who've been expelled can't do anything.
it's difficult. And that's just Vanderbilt. When we got to the three of us got to their encampment, and it's small, but powerful. It's got eight tents, and I'm sure that Columbia has 80 tents or more. But we talked to the kids. We didn't want to bother them too much because we didn't know what the response would be from the campus police. And so we just kind of waved, said hello, and asked if they needed anything. They said they smiled and they said they're okay. So then we headed back towards campus, back through campus, because we wanted to see if we would be stopped by the police, and we weren't. It was a very sleepy campus. Now, why is that? Well, I don't know. I've never seen a campus on a Saturday so quiet, but it could be finals are coming up. It could be kids sleeping in.
So you did not see any police presence?
Not a one. Maybe they think that the protesters have been squashed. I did see a poster that was heavily wrapped and taped onto a tree that included a picture of Eli Motika, the scene reporter. I saw that poster attached to a tree of him being arrested. So they did everything they could to keep that poster on the tree. That's for sure. It's got all kinds of wires. So, and then I got. I'm thinking, well, it's not just Vanderbilt. The stuff is going on everywhere. And so I got a clip. Aaron Mate, he's on the Judge Napolitano on the college students. So here it is.
But the breaking news is that the Prime Minister himself recently called for the silencing of free speech on American college campuses. Before I run the clip, which is very disturbing, what's your take on what's happening on American college campuses? You and I live in the New York City metropolitan area, and we are familiar with what's going on at the Columbia University. If I were on the law school faculty, I'd be marching with the students. What's your take?
I'm just very heartened by the courage and the moral leadership from these brave young people setting up these encampments, not only at Columbia, but at many other schools. Harvard just recently became the latest, I believe. And this is, exam season for students. They have a lot going on, but they're just so outraged at the genocide being waged in their name. that they're doing something about it. And they're recalling the best traditions of this country. You know, college campuses were the source for so much anti-war protest during the Vietnam War and many subsequent foreign disasters and foreign conflicts. So it's just so heartening and encouraging to see young people carrying on in that tradition against really serious intimidation. At Columbia, you have now police assembling and the threat of a raid to break up the encampment. At NYU, you saw police come in and arrest people and then literally construct a wall, or an apartheid wall, you might call it, to keep students out. And not only are they facing physical threats, but also, you know, in the media, being demonized as anti-Semites. There's a huge propaganda campaign right now being pushed by establishment members of both political parties to portray these protests as anti-Semitic. Joe Biden said it. Senator Tom Cotton said it. Senator Tom Cotton said people who are foreigners taking part in these protests should be deported. So there's a huge consensus right now from the establishment to demonize these young people, but they're not being intimidated. And I'm just very encouraged by that.
Senator Tom Cotton even encouraged having fistfights. It seems to me the whole purpose of government, I'm going back to the Declaration of Independence, is to protect the exercise of our rights, foremost among which is the freedom of speech. Without that right, we'd all have British accents. We would never have had the American Revolution. Well, here's what Prime Minister Netanyahu said. It's about 2 minutes long. It's horrific.
And because it's horrific, we're not going to play it, because I'm sure most of us have heard it, but you can easily find this disgusting talk in English by Benjamin Netanyahu about students on campus. And I just want to get back to Aaron Maté's comments about the discussion.
There's so many lies in there, just starting with the notion that somehow these protests are anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish. There are so many Jewish students taking part in these protests. At Columbia, you can see images of people doing Jewish ceremonies. It's Passover right now. They've been honoring that. On the Sabbath, they honored that as well. But, you know, even if there weren't a single Jewish person there, a Jewish person of conscience taking part in these protests, even if there weren't, still the claim of anti-Semitism would be just as ridiculous. Because what are these people actually there for? They're there to protest mass murder, the industrial slaughter of children in Gaza. That's what everyone is opposed to. And the fact that Netanyahu feels compelled to make a video slandering them and urging action against them, it speaks to how dependent he is on U.S. support and how fragile his entire operation is, because he knows what he sees in those protests is moral leadership, which threatens his genocide campaign. He's worried about it spreading. He's worried about other people following suit and catching on and joining the wave of moral courage that it takes to put your body on the line to protest the mass slaughter that he's presiding over. So that's why he feels compelled to come out and make this video, because he knows that he cannot do his mass murder campaign without U.S. support. And he knows what happened during the Vietnam War when massive student protests helped build the momentum to finally put an end to that horrible war. And he's trying to avoid a repeat of that and so many other cases where grassroots movements have had a positive force in the world. So therefore, he's resorting to the lowest libel possible, accusing people of being anti-Semites. And then he says Israel's falsely accused of genocide and starvation. Well, the ICJ disagrees. The International Court of Justice said there are reasonable grounds that Israel might be committing genocide and that this should be investigated further. So many human rights groups have said that Israel is deliberately starving the people of Gaza. Israeli officials have said they're deliberately starving the people of Gaza. So all Netanyahu has is this blatant attempt to weaponize the horrible history of anti-Semitism, the history of the Nazi Holocaust. It's so shameful to try to invoke the Nazi Holocaust, to try to demonize people who are protesting a current Holocaust that he is waging. And he has to call for censorship of these people, which is not the first time he's interfered in U.S. domestic politics. It's amazing how we let this country, this fanatical country, have such an influence on domestic issues to the point where they feel entitled to go ahead and call for censorship of people protesting their crimes.
Thank you for a brilliant and articulate dissection of what he said. I know you hadn't seen that, so your comments were from your head and from your heart, and I thank you for it. It was difficult for me to watch it and difficult for me to play it, but those who are viewing the program understand that we have to expose him for what he is. The head of a criminal government that runs an apartheid that is engaged in genocide, all financed by the American taxpayer.
So that's a clip And it's a short clip. The whole interview is 31 minutes long, and Aaron talks about any number of things. You can find it on YouTube. Just go to Judge Napolitano and Aaron Mate. And I thought he summarized the situation with the students pretty well, Harvey.
Oh yeah, and anybody could have predicted what Netanyahu was going to say. Why do we pay attention to that, and why does he get a platform to do that?
I know, and I
Because
guess
he's
we
been
could.
on cable news umpteen times. I mean, there's not been a Palestinian on cable news yet.
When I watched it, I could not believe the
Oh.
level of lying. Well, anyway, like the judge said, it's a horrible video. The next thing I wanted to bring up was the Freedom Flotilla, because it's been blocked.
Yes, again.
As most of you know, over 20 humanitarian groups, including Veterans for Peace, assembled to take aid to Gaza. But thanks to political pressure from Israel primarily, they have been blocked. And I got a clip just recently about the status of that. And so here's that clip.
This is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you from the Sultan Ahmet Square in central Istanbul, beside the historic Blue Mosque. On the afternoon of April 27, 2024, this afternoon, moments ago, the organizers of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition held a press conference to denounce the decision of the government of Guinea-Bissau, which acted at the behest of Israel's genocidal regime, to withdraw its flag from two of the three vessels that comprised this year's emergency Freedom Flotilla mission to Gaza. You're going to be hearing from the main statements of the organizers in a few moments. I'll be following the progress of this protest before heading back to Athens. We've been advised, the participants, that for the time being, because of the decision of the government of Guinea-Bissau, the vessels of the Freedom Flotilla are effectively blocked indefinitely in the waters of Turkey. But this story, as you can see, is far from over. Their determination does not seem to have been diminished one iota. I'll report back to you shortly.
Good afternoon. My name is Huwaid Araf. I am a Palestinian American human rights attorney and one of the organizers of the Freedom Flotilla. Thursday afternoon, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition was contacted by the Guinea-Bissau International Ships Registry, requesting an inspection of our lead ship, Akdeniz. This was a highly unusual request, as our ships had already passed all required inspections. Nevertheless, we agreed, and the inspector arrived on Thursday late afternoon. On Friday afternoon, before the inspection was even completed, the Guinea-Bissau International Ships Registry, in a blatantly political move, informed the Freedom Flotilla Coalition that it had withdrawn the Guinea-Bissau flag from two of our ships, one of which is our cargo ship, already loaded with over 5,000 tons of life-saving aid for the Palestinians of Gaza. In its communication informing us of this cancellation, the Guinea-Bissau International Ships Registry made specific reference to our planned mission to Gaza. It also made several extraordinary requests for information, including they wanted confirmation of the ship's destination, any additional ports we planned on going to, and the discharge port for humanitarian aid, and the estimated arrival dates and times. It further demanded a formal letter explicitly approving the transportation of humanitarian aid and a complete manifest of the cargo. It is a highly unusual move from a flagging authority. Normally, national flagging authorities concern themselves only with safety and related standards on vessels bearing their flag, and are not concerned with the destination, route, cargo manifests, or the nature of a specific voyage. Just like when you register a car, the authorities don't ask you every place you are going to go with that car. Sadly, the Republic of Guinea-Bissau has allowed itself to become complicit in Israel's deliberate starvation, illegal siege, and genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. Israel is showing the world the extent to which it will go to deny Palestinians the aid they need to stay alive, in direct contravention of international humanitarian law, UN Security Council resolutions, and two orders of the International Court of Justice. Israel is only allowed to get away with this because we have an international order where law does not apply equally, where people are not valued the same, and where supposedly might equals right. The United States has hijacked international law and is even violating its own laws in order to protect Israel at every turn. A leaked USAID memo states that famine in Gaza is inevitable, and that changes in policy could reduce but not stop widespread civilian deaths. It also states that USAID assesses the government of Israel does not currently demonstrate necessary compliance with U.S. law required to receive U.S. military aid. Nevertheless, last week, the U.S. Congress passed and Biden signed a $26 billion aid package to Israel. It is this kind of naked impunity over decades that has brought us to this point where Israel can carry out a genocide that includes a public declaration by its leaders that it is going to deliberately starve children. And not only does it not face consequences, but it is also able to involve a majority of the world government in its crimes. While our governments claim to care about Palestinian lives, they are compliant and even enforcing a situation where a state that has been found to be plausibly committing a genocide is allowed to control what, if any, aid is allowed to get to the people who are trying to stay alive. Yesterday, the UN Special Rapporteurs on the right to food, on the right to housing, and on the situation of human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories issued a statement stating that civil society initiatives like the Freedom Flotilla are important precisely because governments are not complying with their obligations under international law, and many of these governments are even complicit in Israel's siege and genocide. The statement of the special rapporteurs affirmed that ours was a legitimate challenge to Israel's control over the delivery of aid to Gaza, and it demanded safe passage for our flotilla. However, without a flag, we cannot sail. But this is not the end. Israel cannot and will not crush our resolve to break its illegal siege and reach the people of Gaza. The people of Gaza and of all of Palestine remain steadfast under the most horrific, unimaginable conditions. We take strength from their incredible, even inexplicable ability to maintain their humanity, dignity, and hope when this world has given them no reason to do so. It is our responsibility, each and every one of us, to keep that hope alive.
So there was a news conference held by Huwaida Arat, and I'm sure I mispronounced that, so my apologies. But anyway, she's a Palestinian-American activist and civil rights attorney and co-organizer, I believe, for the Freedom Flotilla. Harvey, what do you think? Why doesn't another country just step up and use their flag? Like an Arab country.
Yeah, sure. Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia. I mean, are they just worried about relations with the United States, with relations with Israel that they don't? I mean, how about another country that is...
Yemen.
Why not Yemen? Yeah, exactly.
I don't understand how that licensing works. So
yeah, no, I don't either.
Using, but.
And then the point that she made is all of this pressure from the United States and from Israel really just shows the callousness of Israel and how we continue to support callousness.
Well, and it shows the complete phony concern about bringing in humanitarian aid by sea. Here's the perfect opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're supposedly going to get around to working on the dock at some point.
Understand they haven't started it.
Right. So how do you make a case for delaying that aid? I don't understand. Well, the U.S. be silent about that. Exactly. They don't say anything. They don't say anything. They act like it doesn't exist. You're behind the scenes. They're trying to sabotage anything they can. But
from a positive standpoint, and maybe it's just me looking for it, but since Veterans for Peace sent that letter to the State Department outlining all of the statutes and treaties that we're in violation of, I'm hearing more people talk about how we're legally violating our own laws and statutes.
Yeah.
She mentioned it. Other people have mentioned, you know, we're in violation. And so I'm hoping maybe somebody will pick it up and actually run with it and file suit somewhere. I know I read in Haaretz today that Netanyahu and two of his senior colleagues in the Israeli government is worried about the ICC and
International Criminal Court. Yeah, they're drafting arrest warrants. I mean, I can't wait for that one.
I know. So you see what happens. Now, Veterans for Peace has at least three members on participating. Anne Wright, Barry Reich, and in fact, I just got an email from Barry in which he says, the trip was postponed last Saturday because of the boat flags, which Israel stirred the pot on, and the flag country pulled their flags and had unrealistic requirements to comply with. Israel bought off Guinea-Bissau, the flag-holding country. The boat will plan to sail again with new flags, which other countries have offered. So that's good news. Still uncertain whether Turkey will let the boat go after pressure from the U.S. to stop it. So that's from Barry Reich. Another member of Veterans for Peace, Colleen Rowley.
Oh, yeah. She was the FBI person who talked about 9/11, how she was repeatedly told to quit bringing up the risk of terrorism and to shut down, trying to warn people.
All right. So hopefully we can get them on the show to just give a summation of their experience.
They're risking their lives to do this.
Sure.
You already know the Israelis would not hesitate to kill aid workers. They've done it under every conceivable set of circumstances, including the last time they had a freedom flotilla.
Yeah, that was, and I'm going to mispronounce the name, but something like Marva.
Yeah. Also out of Turkey.
Yeah.
And unarmed, and they killed either 9 or 10.
10 of them.
The crew members or the aid workers on that boat. No, there was never any accountability for that, or nobody was ever prosecuted. And it was on international waters. So they know they can get away with it.
That's right. And why can they get away with it? The U.S.
Yeah.
And
they can get away with killing the U.S. crew on the USS Liberty.
All those years ago, that was 67 war. They had just attacked our ship, but that was just monitoring what was going on.
They can get away with it, so they have nothing holding them back from doing that again.
Speaking of nothing holding them back, National Guard troops on campus?
People are starting to run clips of Kent State because of the talk about the National Guard. You know, the head of ADL said they need to bring out the National Guard. Even and Mike Johnson said we may have to, you know, do that. And, you know, these are armed
thugs.
Thugs. Well, I don't know what the National Guard even is anymore. But,
you know, that is a real worry, especially since I think May 5th is Kent State Day.
May 4th, yeah.
May 4th. Okay. So it's coming up. And that is a real hazard that the students are facing. What is driving me absolutely nuts is they cannot look back at history and see what is happening. and see what happened then, see what the results were, and see what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And they can't make the connection. How stupid are these college presidents and chancellors?
Mm-hmm.
How stupid can they be?
Well, I think they're doing whatever their donors are telling them to do.
And I guess the donors, who would be rich white people for the most part, are just hearkening back to the 1960s, if they're that old, and thinking that the student protests were wrong. Even though history shows that the student protests were right.
I haven't heard anyone mention is that, you know, they're talking about the courage of these students today who are refusing to disperse and, you know, being arrested, being beat up. I mean, some of the tasered and all this horrible stuff. And that was going on back then, too. But the difference between the students then and the students now is there was a draft.
Yep.
These were students who could be sent to Vietnam.
Yep.
These students, you can't really say it's their self-interest.
No. And these students proved that those students way back when, chances are it wasn't their self-interest either. Sure, a lot of them, we had a draft, but there was a lot of girls out there.
Yeah, sure were.
And there was a lot of guys who probably could have figured out a way to get around the draft. So,
well, but, you know, that was always something that pro-war people could use. Oh, they're just cowards and they don't want to go fight. Now they'd have to call them anti-Semites.
That's right. So based on our discussion of the students and based on our bringing up the National Guard, based on Kent State Day coming up.
That's right.
I got the song, Four Dead in Ohio.
That's right.
Because we don't want to repeat that history.
No, there's Ohio State right now with dead encampments.
I wonder if Kent State is doing anything.
I wonder.
If they're not, I don't blame them. So here is Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And let's never repeat that horrific day.
Soldiers and Nixon's gone.